Good evening. My name is Michael Castro. I'm the co-director of the River Styx at Duff's Poetry Series, now in its 23rd year. I'd like to welcome you to this special event, Dr. Martin Luther King Day reading, which is actually a partnership co-sponsored by River Styx Magazine and Left Bank Books. We want the reading, of course, features Allison Joseph, Richard Bergen, and T.C. Boyle. They'll be reading, I believe, in that order, and you'll hear more about and from them in a moment. But we'd like to invoke the evening and pay tribute to Dr. King with this poem called Freedom Ring. Dr. King, Dr. King, when did you hear freedom ring? When the bloodhounds growled and wailed, when sheriffs locked you up in jail, when you sat up front in a bus, when you overcame for us. Dr. King, Dr. King, when did you hear freedom ring? When the tap clicked on your phone, when you prayed at night alone, when a child returned your smile, when you walked the extra mile. Dr. King, Dr. King, when did you hear freedom ring? With civil rights writ into law, with Klansmen pounding at the door, when you won the Nobel Prize, when you looked into deep dark eyes. Dr. King, Dr. King, when did you hear freedom ring? When you lunched with congressmen, when you marched with garbage men, when your dream lit up the night, when your soul beamed in the light. Dr. King, Dr. King, when did you hear freedom ring? When you climbed the mountain high, when the bullet let you die, when your spirit rose to speak, when you turned the other cheek. Dr. King, Dr. King, when did you hear freedom ring? Well, now I'd like to introduce the editor of River Styx Magazine, Richard Newman, who will introduce the first reader.
Howdy, and thanks for coming to our 23rd. I thought it was the 24th season, but it's up there anyway. I'd also like to thank again the Ambiguities. I'd like to introduce them: Ron Sykes on vibraphone, Chris Halzer on trombone, Matthew Henry on drums, and Darren Johnson on bass. I think we've coerced them into playing for intermission and then our walkout music too. The first reader tonight is actually Richard Bergen, who is the editor of Boulevard Magazine and associate professor of communications at St. Louis University. He has published 8 books, including 3 short story collections, Man Without Memory, Private Fame, and most recently, Fear of Blue Skies. Stories from these collections have won 3 Pushcart Prizes. His latest book, Jorge Luis Borges, Conversations, features over a dozen interviews with Borges, one of the indisputable great writers of the 20th century. His novel, Ghost Quartet, is due out next fall, and a second story of Bergen's will be featured in the summer issue of River Styx magazine. I am pleased to introduce my esteemed editorial colleague and very good friend, Richard Bergen.
Oh, thank you. Let me know if... so many people here. Let me know if my voice is not carrying, or I'm going too fast, or not speaking loud enough. Thank you for all coming. It's a pleasure to read in a series for River Styx, wonderfully elegant, hip magazine that sure is one of the things we can be proud about in St. Louis. While I'm in a thanking mode, I was very gratified about the articles in Riverfront Times and St. Louis Post recently about my new book, Jorge Luis Borges Conversations. At the end of the St. Louis Post review, it said I was going to read from the book, and I hadn't planned to do that. I don't see any way I could really effectively read an interview. But I did notice that there were a couple of sonnets by Borges that were printed in their entirety, translated by Willis Barnstone, one of the interviewers in this anthology. So I thought I would begin, before moving to my own work, I thought I would begin by reading these two sonnets by Borges, their English versions, just to give you a little taste of the Borges mind, which is expressed, or part of it expressed fully, I think, in this anthology of his conversations of a lifetime with various writers, including myself. Anyway, both of these poems are quite autobiographical. One of the wonderful things about Borges' poetry is the way they're so directly intimate, which the more famous stories, great as they are, often aren't. So many of you probably know that Borges was mostly blind or completely blind for most of his life. So this this first sonnet is called The Blind Man. The varied world was plundered, gone the sweep of faces that are what they were before, the nearby streets today remote, and more, the hollow blue that yesterday was deep. Yet in the book is only what remains in memory, that form of forgetfulness which keeps the format but undoes the sense, reflecting mere titles. The street contains ambushing breaks and holes, and each step one may be a fall. I am the very slow prisoner of a dreamlike time, who has no way to mark his dawn or his declining sun. It is night. No one is here. With my verse, I must work out my insipid universe. And the second sonnet, which I like very much, is called Remorse. You'll have to take my word for it, those of you who don't know Borges' poetry, that there are counterbalancing celebratory moments, moments of joy in the poetry, these two examples notwithstanding. Actually, this poem, though it's titled Remorse, is about happiness, the importance of happiness, okay, I think, among other things. And I think. Remorse. I have committed the worst sin of all that a man can commit. I have not been happy. Let the glaciers of oblivion drag me and mercilessly let me fall. My parents bred and bore me for a higher faith in the human game of nights and days, for earth, for air, for water, and for fire. I let them down. I wasn't happy. My ways have not fulfilled their youthful hope. I gave my mind to the symmetric stubbornness of art and all its web of pettiness. They willed me bravery. I wasn't brave. It never leads my side since I began, this shadow of having been a brooding man. Okay. Gee, it's hard to transition from Borges to one's own work. I found myself thinking a lot about my father lately, maybe because it wasn't too long ago that I became a father for the first time myself, rather late in life, I realized, which kind of, that's what happened with my father, who was 55 when I was born. So maybe because my son is so precious to me, I've been thinking about my father lately. He, wonderful man, as well as a great musician. violinist and conductor. He was a concert master for many years for Boston Symphony. So I wrote this poem years ago about him and about my relationship to him called Concert Master, and I thought I would read this one poem and conclude the poetic prelude, so to speak, of this little reading. Concert Master for my father. Imagine your old bow father and a berth from violins. That I might be among arpeggios, I discreetly scattered my sins. When I was 9, you 66. That I might not dwell among dead violas, I began to dread your death. You still seem one of God's tricks. That we could ignore our mutual flesh, we played chess and talked of Mahler. We pledged to avoid exteriors. We scarcely remembered to dress. These things I can now remember. We were always composing lists. Our society was usually sky. We longed for invisible trysts. He that he may need him, he that he may rest from need, he that he may follow him, he that he may rest from sin. Listen, Father, to what I know. Fathers are time and sons are loss. Listen, Father, to what I remember. Fathers are time and sons are rhyme. Now I'd like to finish with a little story from my most recent collection called Fear of Blue Skies. And the name of this story is Body Surfing. It takes place in Costa Rica. That's really all I guess I'll say about it. It's called Body Surfing. There was a rustling. Then Lee saw it, fat and gray and big-eyed with an orange crown as it slid across the path. They were going to have the last laugh, the iguanas, that was for sure. There were so many of them. Costa Rica was going to be their world someday. The path ended and the boogie board banged against his knee. He swore out loud as he began walking down the road. It was madness, sheer madness to have rented the board. He knew that within 2 minutes. He knew that when he reached the first wave. There was the wave and his body, and nothing ever should come between them. That alone should be pure. Sheer lunacy to think otherwise. He looked at it, baby blue with a dangling wrist strap like an umbilical cord, this boogie board with its silly name. It was idiocy in its purest form to let it ruin his rides, to let it bang about in the wind and hit his knee. Why had he done it? Why? It was because he'd remembered his wife saying they were so much fun. Years ago she had said that. He had a distant memory of it. It was that and the surfboard morons who were taking over the ocean, crowding him out of his space. He'd let them intimidate him, let them infantilize him into thinking he should maybe get some kind of board of his own. So when he left the beach and saw it in the store, he'd rented it on an impulse. It was the same store that was in front of him now, the Palm Store, a combination travel agency and gift shop run by a good-looking man and his wife with a yellow-haired kid who didn't look like either of them, certainly not the man. So he would return it now, 11 minutes after he took it. Of course he wouldn't ask for his money back. He would take responsibility. They would wonder why, perhaps ask him why, but he wouldn't let himself worry about it. He was about to lose his job in 2 weeks, about to be transferred to a lower job in the bank in a different city. To be screwed over like that at his age and with his mother at death's door, too. No, he wasn't going to worry about returning a boogie board to a store that looked like it was made out of cards, as every other store in Tamarindo did, with its pathetically corny painting of a sun sinking below the waves, a store that rented surfboards and goggles and boogie boards and tickets for turtle tours. He went inside the Palm Store. A tall, attractive blonde man, a surfboard oron, perhaps 2 inches taller than he was, perhaps a dozen years younger, perhaps with 14 better defined muscles than he had finished talking, to the owner and was fingering a surfboard as Lee placed the boogie board beside it. "He is going to ask me how I like the boogie board," Lee thought. "He is going to try to have a conversation with me." The blond man turned toward Lee. "He is from California," Lee thought. "How did it ride?" the blond man said. "How did it ride? It didn't ride at all. I didn't have any use for it. Surf too strong today? Board too superfluous today? Or any day?" "Okay, I hear you." Lee was struck by how straight the surfer's teeth were, which perhaps accounted for the extraordinary hang time of his smile. "I don't like anything to come between me and the wave, me and the water. I think that relationship ought to stay pure. Today I violated that relationship, I'm sorry to say. Today I let myself be conquered by a product, and I corrupted that relationship." The blonde man's smile vanished, and Lee felt vindicated. "I don't think I get what you mean." "These boards," Lee said, indicating the blonde man's surfboard with his gesture. "They're just another way people have found to make money off the water. They're about buying and selling, that's all." The blonde man showed a second smile, a quizzical but still friendly one. "I guess I don't see it that way," he said. "Really? How do you see it, then?" "They're just a piece of equipment for a sport. They're just a means to an end, like you can't play baseball without a bat or football without a ball, can you?" Lee felt an adrenaline rush. Apparently, the man really wanted to discuss this. "There was a time when you could play sports without buying things," Lee said. "To me, the more a sport costs, the less its value. The more it's about buying these accessories, the more of a fetish it becomes instead of a sport. By the way, I hope I didn't desecrate the flag, so to speak, with my remarks about surfboards. I know you guys get sensitive about that." "No, man, I don't mind. I just never met anyone who thinks like you. It's kind of interesting, really." Lee felt flattered in spite of himself. Ridiculous to feel that in this situation, though he did for a moment, and thought he should soften himself. Besides, he was beginning to get an idea, and he needed time to figure it all out. Just before he spoke, he made a point of looking at the surfer's eyes. "And by the way, I know whereof I speak," Lee said. "I'm a banker. You can't be much more of a whore than that. My whole life is buying and selling. I'm in middle management at Citibank. Need I say more? Or I soon will be. I was actually at a somewhat higher level of management, but that's like bragging about being in a higher circle of hell, isn't it? But at least on my vacation, I want to stay pure when I'm in the water. I said to my secretary, 'I don't care what kind of hotel you get me,' and she got me Le Jardin d'Eden, the most expensive one in Tamarindo, but I insist on big, world-class waves. I want you to research that for me." "Well, the waves here are certainly world-class, and they deserve the best from me." Lee looked closely at the man, who in turn appeared to be concentrating intensely on what Lee said. "So, I'm on my way now. I'm going to have my twilight drink, and again, I hope I haven't offended you at all." "No way. I enjoyed talking with you. You're the first American I've spoken to in 3 days. I don't speak Spanish, so I've practically been talking to myself since I've been here." Lee looked at him closely once more, wondering if he were gay or just needy or perhaps one of those friendly New Age types. He had decided something important, something definitive in the waves yesterday, but this young man might make it even better. Besides, he was a surfer, and that would make him the cherry on the sundae, and his possible gayness would never even enter into it. "I've enjoyed it too," Lee said. "Hey, you know the restaurant Zulimar?" "Sure." "That's where I'm going for my drink. Why don't you join me and have one on the bank?" The blonde man laughed. "Sure, my name's Andy," he said, extending his hand. "I'm Lee Bank, or should I say Le Bank. And we all know what shape banks are in." Lee turned and walked out of the store, and Andy followed after him, still laughing. "Is Bank really your last name?" "I'm sometimes known as Lee Bastard, or when I'm in Paris as Le Bastard. But we are far from Paris now, aren't we?" Lee looked straight ahead as they walked down the dirt road and seemed unaware that Andy was walking beside him. It was not much of a road, Lee thought, full of holes and rocks and puddles. So they could have, should have left it alone and not put up so many toy-like stores. Laughable, really, how small they were, the little shack that probably doubled as someone's home, with a giant sign saying nachos and ice cream, a sign that was half as big as the shack. Pathetic, really, the hut beside it, called Jungle Bus, that advertised killer burger and munchies. If the puddle on the road in front of it rose a couple of inches, it could swallow the Jungle Bus. Zulimar was on the other side of the road, facing the Jungle Bus on one side and the beach on the other. It was a big, by Tamarindo standards, open-air restaurant and bar filled with surfers, the same crowd that forced him off his path 2 days in a row in the water and actually made him yearn for a lifeguard to patrol things. A wall mural that clashed with the red floor depicted a pink pelican circling over some anchored boats and a small island beyond that, the approximate scene outside. Across the street at another bar, a man was playing the marimba with two little boys. Lee and Andy sat down at a table facing the water and looked briefly at the half-filled room. As soon as they focused on each other, Lee said, "You'll want a beer, won't you? Isn't that what you guys drink, favor?" He had a tight, sarcastic, semi-sarcastic smile, and Andy smiled back. "What do you mean? You surfers, you surf wizards. You don't want to drink anything too hard, anything that might put you at risk when you go out on your boards again." "I'm done surfing for the day, and I drink lots of things, no routine." "Fine. Dose my tide," he said to the waiter. The incredulous smile reappeared on Andy's face. Lee was going to say something to try to get rid of it, but Andy spoke first. "You've got some negative feelings towards surfers, don't you?" Lee shrugged. "What do they do to you, man?" Andy said, half laughing. His hand absently caressing his board for a moment, Lee noticed, as if he really thought the goddamn thing was alive. "Did they run into you once or something?" "No, that would never happen, though they have crowded me out more than once here in Tamarindo, kept me from where I wanted to go. But believe me, I stick to my own path. I don't mingle. I am not only on a different path from them, I'm in a different world." "But what's so different about your world?" "Night and day, Andy, night and day." "Why? What do? You body surf, right? I respect that." "So I get up on a board and you body surf. Have you ever surfed?" "I do surf. I mean with a board. Years ago, when I was actually young." "So what do you have against it?" The drinks came. Andy took a big swallow while Lee let his sit. "It's about buying and selling again. Kids see it on TV and ads and think, that's it. Then they make movies about it and create a surfing tour and sell all this equipment, all these fetishes. And the young guys think, if I do this, I'll be a man. If I do this, I'll get some first-class pussy. It will all happen if I can just buy the right board." Andy was laughing now. He was not an easy man to offend, Lee concluded as he sipped his drink. "I'm not agreeing with you, by the way," Andy said. "I just think what you're saying is funny and interesting in a way. Of course, you think that surfboarding is the greater sport, the greater challenge, don't you? After all, you stand up. You are Homo erectus, whereas I am still on all fours. You go out further to sea, whereas I am nearer the shore. You walk on water like Jesus Christ, whereas I only ride with it like a fish. And then when gravity must eventually bring you down, you take the deeper, more heroic fall. You think all those things, don't you?" "I just enjoy surfing. I haven't thought it out like that, really. And like I say, I respect what you do. I wonder if you know what I do. Because there are a number of body surfers out there. It isn't just me. And very few of them know when or how to jump. And once they do jump, how to go over the wave. They almost always start too late." "I probably wouldn't know, man. Isn't that the way it is with everything? We don't really understand the other person's thing or point of view." "Dose my tie," Lee said, catching the waiter's attention, although he had not yet made significant progress on his first drink. "So now tell me your story, Andy. What brings you to glorious Tamarindo?"
Andy looked flustered, ran his fingers twice through his longish blonde hair. He could be Cato Kalin's younger brother, Lee thought. I just came here to surf. From whence did you come then? Santa Cruz in California? Lee smiled tightly again. This is your vacation then? You came to Tamarindo directly on your vacation? Not exactly. I was in Monteverde first. I went to Costa Rica directly, but I went to Monteverde first, in the mountains. Then you are a mountain man, too. Andy lowered his head a little. Lee couldn't tell if he were burying his smile or giving birth to a new one. In Tamarindo, smiles were the iguanas on every surfer's face. Lee distrusted smiles in general because he had discovered that if you believed in them, a time would come when that belief would hurt you. He remembered he had once been very moved by his wife's smile. So, how were the mountains? He finally said. Some bad stuff happened there, so I came here earlier than I expected. I'm sorry to learn that. What exactly was the bad stuff? The waiters came with the new drinks, and Andy took a big swallow as the waiter took his first glass, while Lee carefully placed his second glass next to his first, which was still three quarters full, as if he were positioning two bowling pins. The woman I was with went bad on me. She met a dude on the tour we took in the cloud forest. He was older than me. Around your age, I guess. And he had a lot more money than me, you know. I was never very good at making money. I just helped run a little Xerox store. But this rich guy was a businessman, a big businessman, though he was in the same hotel as us, only he was in some luxury suite. Anyway, she told me she was sorry. She said she didn't plan it that way, that it was a once-in-a-million thing, but she thought he was the man for her, and she was going to go with him for the rest of her vacation and beyond. So what could you do? Just got drunk. Woke up alone the next morning, got in my Suzuki, and came down here because I said this was where the surf was, and they didn't lie about that. Last couple of days, I took it out on the waves, 6-7 hours a day, and just flushed that bitch right out. It hurt, though, I'll tell you. So when you talk about money corrupting things, I really hear you. And when you talk about women being bitches, I hear you. I lost my sense of smell from a woman once. How'd that happen? Andy's incredulous smile had snuck back, Lee noted, as if it were taking a curtain call. I discovered my female friend had cheated on me, and I got extremely ill in an odd way. I developed a sinus condition that's never really gone away. I think it was my ex-wife who did me wrong, or it might have been someone else before her. Over the years, people tend to blur together, don't they? Anyway, I have very little to do with women now. The only woman in my life besides Mother C is my secretary, and she's far too valuable to bother having sex with. I am completely dependent on her. It was she who arranged this trip for me. Of course, I'll lose her when I'm transferred to my next job, but that's the way it is with women. We always lose them. They were put here on Earth so we would know what losing is. Even when we have them, we lose them. Did you ever think about that? What do you mean? We watch them lose their looks, their charm, their ability to have children, their sex. We lose our mothers too, and then our wives become our mothers, and we lose them again. We lose our mothers a second time. But men age too, Andy said. But we don't notice it as much since we don't desire men, do we? Anyway, you don't have to worry about all this now. It'll be years before you'll have to realize this. I realize it. I realize some of it now. Then you might consider giving them up, as I have. You can get a greater high than the orgasm from body surfing. At least you can the way I body surf. Andy looked away morosely. Lee waited a minute. There was a rustling sound in the restaurant as if the waiters were really iguanas. Lee couldn't stand hearing it, so he spoke. Thinking about her, he said? Yeah. How long were you two an item? Just a couple of months, but impact can be made in a couple of months. Impact can be made in a minute if we allow it to happen. I understand. Yeah, I thought this one would work out. I had hopes. Ah, hopes, Lee said, gesturing vaguely toward the sea. Listen, I have an idea for you, a proposal to make to you. It does not involve hope, but something better. It involves a challenge. Go on. Something very special happened to me yesterday. Do you know that inlet that separates our beach from the one that goes straight to the mountains? Yes. Have you ever been on that other beach? No, no one surfs over there, so I just assume there wasn't much there. That's precisely the point. The beach goes on for miles, but because there's no access from the road, because there is a thick jungle of trees to walk through and no other way to reach it unless you swim across the inlet, there is almost no one there. Well, yesterday, I swim across that inlet. It was sunset a little earlier than now, and the swim wasn't easy, but I found the beach deserted and astonishingly beautiful. There were no footprints on the sand, just the swerving lines of hermit crabs and twisted branches from trees. I don't think there were even any butterflies. It wasn't civilized enough for them. It was like being on the moon or on a new planet. The waves were enormous, and there was no one around to get in my way. My path was totally clear. Why don't you go there with me now and body surf with me? Leave your board at your old hotel room and just go there with me now. I know you've only known me 30 minutes or whatever it's been. I know it's getting dark and it's a little dangerous. It's not that dangerous. I could do that. Fine. Marvelous. Here. Why don't you have my other drink? I haven't touched it. And I'll finish my first one, and then we'll go out together and meet the waves with our bodies alone. I promise you it will be extraordinary. Yeah, okay, Andy said, looking Lee straight in the eye. I'll go with you. I'm open to it. They finished their drinks quickly, and Lee paid the bill. The moment he put the money in the waiter's hand, he saw the sun slip below the water. Some people were watching it in the restaurant, and beyond them, others watched from the beach. It was an understandable ritual, Lee thought. It had been advertised like a Citibank card, and people needed to see the promise delivered. In her condominium in Florida, his mother was probably watching it too from her wheelchair, perhaps with one of her nurses. She more than anyone believed in advertised beauty. All her life she believed in Jackie Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe and Marlon Brando and Holiday Inns and sunsets. It would not do any good to tell her the deeper beauty came after the sunset, came with the night when the whole world slid below water. She had never listened to him. They should have switched positions. She should have worked for Citibank, and he should have been the cripple. He might have done well in a chair. There were only occasional street lamps outside, but he could see the night was thick with butterflies. They were not talking now, so he could hear another iguana slide past in front of him. Then he decided it wouldn't have mattered if they were talking. He would have heard it anyway. In Tamarindo, every sound on earth was an iguana. You could only escape them in the water. There's your hotel, Lee said, pointing to the Diria, barely bigger than the travel agency, it seemed. Why don't you drop your board off here? You won't be needing it. It'll only get in the way. Okay, Andy said softly. He walked off in the dark, and Lee waited in the road, thinking he should have told him, go put your dick away there, too. That's what your board really is. You won't be needing it where we're going. There aren't any dicks in the ocean, not in the night ocean. Andy came back. Lee had never really considered that he wouldn't. Let's go, Lee said. There were about 50 yards of road before they reached the path that led to the beach. The deep orange of the sky had passed. It was now a dark purple and silver, tinged with spots of fading pink. There were not many people on the beach, and most of them were leaving. Except for the white of the waves, the ocean was dark. It gets dark quickly, Andy said. Drops like a plank, Lee said. He is very young, Lee thought, and his fear is showing. Lee thought of himself as 1,000 years old. This will be good for him. He needs to put on 100 years. Then he didn't think about him anymore. They walked the length of the beach toward the inlet. Andy was talking about the girl who had dumped him, whose name was Dawn. Forget the girl, Lee said. Drown her in the ocean. When they reached the inlet, the sky was nearly black. There were lots of stars out and 3/4 of a moon. I was hoping it would be low tide so we could walk across, Andy said. We can swim it, Lee said. He threw the towel he'd been carrying into the sky, and the black swallowed it. What did you just do? I threw my towel away. I won't be needing it. It It's a hotel towel. Yeah, you told me about your hotel. Very impressive. Supposed to be the best hotel in Tamarindo. There was sarcasm, even a trace of contempt in Andy's voice that stung Lee for a second. The hotel can drop dead, Lee said as he walked into the water. He was surprised again by how wide the inlet was, but he didn't feel tired this time while he was swimming. He could hear Andy breathing heavily, almost gasping as he swam beside him, and thought for a moment that he shouldn't have let him drink three Mai Tais. Stop racing, he said, nearly yelling. Stop trying to beat me. It's not a race. You have to pace yourself. Andy slowed down the rest of the way. When they reached the shore of the deserted beach, there were only a few slivers of sky that weren't black. I wish it were lighter, man, Andy said. Why? I can't see things you said would be here. I can't see the things you promised. Yes, you can. Look harder. I can barely see in front of myself. I can look at anything and see the beauty in it, especially the dark. Tell me what I was supposed to see here again and walk slower, will you? I can barely keep up with you. Twisted tree branches and hermit crab lines, Lee said. Lee walked briskly, saying nothing for the next few minutes. Andy ran after him, stumbling occasionally, trying to keep up with him, or at least keep him in sight, feeling like he did when he was a child, trying to keep up with his father's longer, relentless stride. Come on, we're going in the water. It's time to face the black water now. Lee walked toward the ocean in fast, imperious strides, like a fixated scoutmaster, Andy thought. Slow down, will you? Why are you racing? Andy said, and then repeated himself, yelling this time, because the ocean was so loud he felt he wasn't being heard. Lee kept walking into the water without changing speed, the big, blustery businessman from the fancy hotel who had to know it all, who had to take what he wanted when he wanted it. Why had he listened to him? Why had he come with him to this crazy beach? He was chasing after him in the water now while his legs felt like rubber. The water was up to his knees, and he knew something was wrong, had known it for some time. Lee, he yelled. Lee! Lee Bastard! A few seconds before, he'd seen him 15 yards ahead, propelling himself forward, not even ducking for the waves, but somehow willing himself forward, like a man walking into a wall, into the earth, until the water covered him. Andy heard himself scream. It might have been Lee. It might have been help. His legs wouldn't move at first, and when they could, he knew he wouldn't move them, because he'd already known Lee wanted to be witnessed while he disappeared by a sucker like Andrew, just as Don had, and one of those humiliations was enough. Lee legend gets back at a surfer. Lee Lemming. Lee, he screamed. Lee Bastard. Knowing who would see and hear nothing now, except the constant roar in the black, and his own sickly voice boomeranging back at him like spit in the wind, because the bastard had wanted it this way. Thanks.
Known, came to America at 7, by 13 wrote poems, at 20 wrote, some view that sable race with scornful eye, their color is a diabolic dye. I open the paper, read, slavery brought blacks here to share in the country with the greatest opportunity on earth. A man in Michigan calls racism unfair. Asks, would anyone know Cosby, Jackson, or Murphy if they were born in Africa? Phyllis wrote, I, young in life, was snatched from Africa's fancied happy seat, her nation's curio, the foreword to her poems signed by 18 famous Massachusetts men. Finally freed, she died alone at 31, obscure in a rundown boarding house. It's all buying and selling, I think. Try to divine what Phyllis knew beyond pious couplets. Remember Christians, Negroes, black as Cain can be refined and join the angelic strain. I can't guess much. my language not falling easily into couplets, breaking down when I examine it, the concept of race as actual and arbitrary as anger. My cousin, bored now with the television, wanders away, content to push his fire engine across the floor, slowly, intently, inch by inch. And here's the flip side of the black experience. That's the stupidest phrase, I think, the black experience, because there is no one black experience. There are a whole lot of black people in this world with a lot of different experiences, some of which may coincide. That's why I write poems. Hopefully, my experiences do coincide with other people's. This poem is the title poem to my second book. It's called Soul Train. And there's a flip side of this poem. If you know Michael Waters' poem, American Bandstand, I don't know if I was consciously thinking of Michael's poem when I wrote this one, but the two complement each other. Soul Train. Oh, how I wanted to be a dancer those Saturday mornings in the living room, neglecting chores to gape at the whirling people on our television, the shapely and self-knowing brown-skinned women who dared stare straight at the camera, the men, strong, athletically gifted as they leaped, landed in full splits. No black people I knew lived like this, dressed in sequins, makeup, men's hair slicked back like 40s gangsters, women in skin-tight, merciless spandex, daring heels higher than I could imagine walking in, much less dancing, and that dancing full of sex, swagger, life, a communal rite where everyone arched, swayed, shimmered and shimmied, hands over head in celebration, bodies moving to their own influences, life under music pumping from studio speakers beneath the neon letters that spelled out Soul Train, the hippest trip in America. I try to dance to keep up, moving like the figures on the screen, hoping the rhythm could hit me in that same hard way, that same mission of shake and groove, leaving my dust rag behind, ignoring the furniture and the polish to step and turn as they did. My approximation nowhere near as clever or seductive, faking it as best I knew how, shaking my 12-year-old self as if something deep depended upon the right move, the righteous step, the insistent groove I followed, yearning to get it right, to move like those dancers, blessed by funk, touched with rhythm, confident in their motions, clothes, their spinning, and experienced bodies. Funny, looking at that poem, I'm still leaving the dust rag behind. I'm just not dusting. And the spandex is still merciless. If you get up on Saturday morning and watch Soul Train, you will see the spandex is still merciless. This next poem I'm reading for a very sentimental reason. I'm an email demon. I have like 65 email addresses. I use just one of them. But whenever I'm on a website and it says free email, I sign up for them. So I got an email the other day from my high school English teacher. My high school English teacher, I was so flattered and happy and amazed, and I wrote back and told him about my life, and it made me start thinking about high school, and this is a high school poem. I grew up in the Bronx in New York, and I went to a high school called, and now this sounds very strange for a poet, but I went to a high school called the Bronx High School of Science. Hey! And the great thing about science is it's a high school that, though it was in the Bronx, it attracted kids from all over the city because you had to take this entrance exam. You know the deal. You had to take the entrance exam to get in, and, you know, if you got a certain score, you could go. So this poem's called The Lost Daughters, to the Lost Daughters of Bronx Science. Where are you now, Carol Aronowitz, sassiest Jewish girl I ever knew, with your red gold hair and your dreams of Greenwich Village nightclubs, your poems which begat my poems, your small shoulders that did not sag, your fire, your anger, your strut that cheered me out of gym class and into the school parking lot where I nearly keeled over, clutching my stomach as menstrual cramps rolled through it. And where are you now, Georgiana Hsu, with your courtesan's smile and easy grace, your round, seductive Asian face, troubled by mathematics, your romances found in dime store paperbacks, you read faster than anyone, trading them before the school day began, before chemistry and physics left us all baffled, a little less wild. Where are you, Smita and Kathy, sisters by choice, one of you dark, Indian, the other pale, Irish, both of you crazy enough to insist on being friends in a world that divides by color, brave enough to take on Manhattan, dressed for dancing at the Peppermint Lounge or underground, underage girls needing a fix of nightlife, assurance of a world beyond chem lab, history class, beyond the PSAT, SAT, all those scores that finally tested nothing but our patience. And where is Karen Chin, who showed me the proper way to use chopsticks, and Claudia Probst, who believed the power of words went far beyond our leaden textbooks, and Edna Bondoc, and Soumeng Tseng, and Cyrilline Critchlow, too. Where is she? All those girls who knew how to move through this world, who knew that city like a gift, turning it inside out, using it, walking its streets, taking subways, buses, wise in the ways of mass transit. And where is Aphrodisia McCannon, who first showed me the sooty aisles of the Strand bookstore, who got chased out of a Chinese restaurant with me, our tips too meager? And what of Bernie and Kathy and Gail, black girls who dared venture into Lord and Taylor's, aware that the woman following us was a security guard, making sure we didn't steal what we couldn't buy? They're gone now, first to Yale, Cornell, Oberlin, Barnard, Princeton, Wesleyan, and then beyond, hurtling headlong into marriages and jobs, still smarter than their teachers, into law school and graduate school, still smarter than their professors, into lives I've lost track of, their dazzling projects lost to me, new feats I know nothing of but can imagine, girls who chose me as friend, who didn't overlook or underestimate me, who taught me a multiplicity of customs, mannerisms, colors, bits of different languages from all across the city. For 4 years in that squat Bronx building, you taught me to gossip, to dance, to lose myself in sudden hysterical teenage laughter over boys or evil teachers, our futures hovering, though safely out of reach, beyond us in moments of comradeship. Confidence is shared in bathrooms or across crowded lunchroom tables, secrets I no longer remember anything of, except how close they brought us. Such friendships, bountiful, sustaining, far more real than tests or grade point averages, far keener than what I know now, lulled by adulthood. At Bronx Science, your grade point average was really important, more important than your cup size. I've been married for 7 years. My wonderful husband is over there in the back. But we didn't really have a wedding. We had a 4-minute civil ceremony, which our best men, Joe and Joe, missed. But If I were to have a wedding, I'd have the wedding that's in this poem. It's the original bad taste wedding, I think. This is called Wedding Party, and I did write it before the disco revival. Wedding Party. I wanted to have a wedding where a band called Sexual Chocolate would play cover versions of Turn the Beat Around and Got to Be Real, tunes so disco everyone's forsaken them in the oh-so-cynical 90s. I wanted my bridesmaids in orange tulle, groomsmen in light green, their cummerbunds so wide their waist became some thick, enticing region, regal as an alleyway. I wanted folks to glide onto the dance floor, doing quaint, antiquated dances like the funky chicken, Latin hustle, polyester divas doing moves so fine, even Shaft himself would have to stop, grin his approval. I wanted finger foods and snack sizes, a wedding cake piled so high in gumdrops and coconut that no one's blood sugar level would be safe. I wanted it crass and big and ugly, bad enough to make relatives shudder whenever they remembered my denim patchwork gown, platform heels. Instead, I'm here at the city clerk's office, an ordinary woman in an ordinary dress, marrying an ordinary man in ordinary shoes. Still, I know that party is going on somewhere, if only in the strange regions of my mind. Music and costumes by earth, wind, and fire, catering by Mama and Company. And the MC, of course, is a dapper black man who wishes us love, peace, and soul. Our lives, one everlasting ride on the soul train bound for Boogie Wonderland. Little Stevie's harmonica blowing us one last tune in the key of life. As you can tell, music is one of my chief inspirations as a poet. This is another poem that has a lot to do with music. A lot of my love of music comes from my father, who passed away in December of 1997. And even before he died, I wrote about him a lot because he embodies all these different contradictions, particularly for an African-American man, in his case, someone from the West Indies. But I think this poem, what I tried to do in this particular poem was get to the heart of the contradictions that made him so interesting to me as his daughter and as a writer. My father's heroes, not JFK, not MLK, certainly not Ronald Reagan or Edward I. Koch. No, instead my father chose to glory in the feats of cool Papa Bell, quickest man in the Negro Leagues, able, Dad bragged, to flick off a light switch, then dart into bed before the room went dark. Praising the fast dancing feet of the Nicholas brothers, he called my attention to their rapid fire acrobatics, but saved his true love for Peg Leg Bates, the one-legged tap dancer who'd pound out a furious rhythm on his wooden leg, dazzling audiences with leaps, hops, bounds. I never saw Father anywhere near a piano, but he still schooled me about Jimmy Russian, Mr. 5x5, tagged so because he stood 5 feet tall and looked 5 feet wide. Had me humming Jelly Roll Morton's Creole jazz, though he'd never been near New Orleans. Made certain I knew the difference between Fats Domino and Fats Waller. played me the Harlem Rhapsodies of Ellington so loudly I thought the orchestra had come to visit Sir Duke himself in our living room, elegant in top hat, tails. To Dad, Satchmo and Satchel Paige both deserved equal praise. Equal adulation was given to the theatrics of Louis Jordan as he belted out rhythm and blues tunes about hard-headed women like Caldonia. The hidey-ho of Cab Calloway as he spun tales of Minnie the Moocher, regal in yards of Zoot Suit. And to the sublime grace of Mr. B, Billy Eckstein crooning smoother than any white man. Coleman Hawkins, Lester Young, Bird and Diz all came to play from our raspy console hi-fi, its needle worn, jumping over scratches. But some mornings I'd wake to hear a woman's voice filling our rooms with trembling love songs, a voice so vulnerable, even I understood, even though the language was French, the singer white. This, he'd say, is Piaf, the little sparrow. And I'd listen to that voice send its sorrows through our house, and I knew that what touched my father wasn't always race, wasn't always color. Somehow he knew I needed to hear this woman sing from her fragile bones, her sound silencing us both, as her crowds in Paris must have been when they saw her tiny figure on the stage, bent over to sing the last vestiges of a ballad, the last words she'd give them. Read two more poems. I live at Carbondale, which is about 2 hours from here. If you've been there, you know it's a pretty nice town. It's a university town. A lot of our students come from the Chicago area, or as they tell me, the Chicagoland area. But the one thing that drives me absolutely nutty about Carbondale is that there is no place to eat, no place good to eat. When we have visiting writers and we have a pretty nice series, people come in, give readings and that sort of thing, there's always this big debate. Where are we gonna take them? Where are we gonna take them? We had a Japanese restaurant and a Middle Eastern restaurant, and we'd switch off between them, and then the Middle Eastern restaurant closed and replaced by a place called the Checkered Flag, which is a NASCAR restaurant. It's all NASCAR all the time. And the food is absolutely dreadful. What have you eaten there? We could tell you. I think we had the Jeff Gordon table or something like that. So I think a lot about food all the time. We try to get a good meal in when we come to St. Louis or when we go to Chicago. But I think this poem was a direct result of living in a place that does not have decent restaurants. And then I realized how sexual the poem was after I'd written it. Hence the title, Eating Out. Eating Out. Don't you love that moment when they place the menu before you? All your choices spelled out in details of tarragon or fennel, star anise or roasted chile. I love that moment too when the waiter goes through his litany of specials, the curried, poached, glazed, drizzled, blackened, sauced, blanched, roasted, one day only, sorry we've run out of that dishes, the candied, sinful, chocolate rich, creme de menthe, devil's food, strawberry sauced and raspberry tarted desserts. It's like the orgasm before the orgasm. The minor ripple that precedes the blast, your body knows as full pleasure. So go ahead, order the soup. Let its creamy warmth slide over your tongue in pursuit of the apt taste buds. Have the appetizer, white cheese and olive oil softening the crusty coat of bread wedges. Taste something you've never had, can't pronounce. Enoki mushrooms, arugula, creme fraiche au velou. Eat slowly, for you did not cook this yourself. Nor did someone hand it to you in a paper bag with plastic forks. Don't just chew, but lick, savor. Your tongue caressing the roof of your mouth, flavors you've hoped for all week finally here, flooding your mouth. When you're sated, sigh. We started off this reading talking about Dr. King, and I want to throw another man into the pantheon, a man of peace. And this poem is also a love poem. It's for my husband. And I have to sing while I read this poem. So I think I can do it. I think my voice is up to it. Usually it's no problem. I can do it. But since I've been so scratchy lately. So this is called My Husband Plays Me, Marley. And it's one of those poems where the title just sort of bleeds into the front, first line, the front line. My husband plays me, Marley, more than any white man born and bred in Arkansas should. So much that I think any day now he will wake with a head full of dreads, big spliff between his lips like Marley's on the album covers. In this age of CDs, he actually owns the albums, even the one where the cover tells you how to clean herb. Though I'm the one with the mother from Jamaica, he's the one leading me through get up, stand up, and Rastaman vibration. I guess that makes me Rita to his Bob. And I'm so glad to sing with him to give thanks and praises to a God I wouldn't refer to otherwise. He makes me name each whaler, fills me with stories of Bunny and Peter Tosh. Bunny could sing while Peter talked his way through a song. Marvels with me at how much Ziggy looks like his dad, even if the younger Marley isn't nearly as astonishing musically. I think Bob would smile if he knew us, laughing at my husband, even though he's a crazy bald head, a white man like the white captain who married Marley's 18-year-old mother, only sent money after their son was born. When my husband croons, "No woman, no cry," he changes the words, sings the name of our town instead of Trench Town, and I begin to think I could live anywhere with him. Any place we can open windows, drapes, let in a pale imitation of the sun Marley knew. Nowhere we can go where Marley can't follow, singing sweet songs, melodies clear and true. This is Marley's message to us, and we are grateful this messenger once walked this earth, telling us every little thing is gonna be all right. And we listen, dance to his voice in the light of our lives. Thank you.